The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Please welcome our first presenter, Damaris B. Hill.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming out. I'm very pleased to meet and commune with you this evening. I'm trying something new at my readings because of the current cultural climate. If everybody could close their eyes and kind of put their hand near their heart and acknowledge that you recognize the humanness within yourself, and anything that has been less than human today, that you forgive yourself for it. If you will all wait, when you finished, if you will grab the hand of your neighbor and give them the same affirmation, I would appreciate it. Thank you. I stand here, bound in the legacy of love, in the midst of the ricochet, in solidarity with the hurt and the wounded, whether they occupy this life or the next. Like Jania McClellan, Sandra Bland, Freddie Gray, Samuel Du Bois, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, Cynthia Hurd, DePayne Middleton Doctor, Miss Susie Jackson, and her cousin, Ms. Ethel Lance, Senator Reverend Clementa Pinckney, Tawazia Sanders, Reverend Dr. Daniel Simmons Sr., Pastor Myra Thompson, Eric Gardner, Trayvon Martin, Tamia Rice, Eric Harris, Walter Scott, Jonathan Farrell, Renita McBride, Philanda Castile, and others. The afflicted pray for healing, just as the hungry pray for bread, but when has God ever sent bread? In my recollection of the scriptures, God has always sent a woman like Eve and the unnamed woman that preceded her, a woman like Moses' mother, Jochebed, and the woman that raised him to be a king, Bathia, a woman like Deborah and her skull-piercing homegirl, Jael, maybe some manna, but when has God ever sent bread? Like history, I am older than I look. My white ancestors immigrated to this country in the 1780s. My African and indigenous ancestors were already here. My mother is in labor with me in 1974. She and my father wished for a son they thought would unite them. I come, a woman in the body of a girl, 3.5 weeks late, breaking my mother in too many ways. She hadn't the energy to name me. My father was too lazy to be original. He scribbled my mother's name on the certificate and wrote the name of his mother right behind the wife's name. This ritual of naming is one way we learn to love and bind with people who no longer share the planet with us. In these poems, the legacy of these women's lives chases me like a strong wind. This book is a love letter to the women that have been denied their humanity. Most of these women have been forgotten, shunned, or erased. Every time I call the name of a woman in this book, presume that that person is loved. If you are brave, imagine the name of that woman congealing on my tongue. Give the name's breath and memory. Let these women dance among your days and with your nights. Dream better lives. So I'm going to read a series of poems today. And some of you that have the book or have access to portions of the book know that the book is comprised of archives, histories, and then poems. And I do view these poems as like psalms and praise songs. So I'm going to read a number of them to you today. I'm going to begin with my grandmother, go on to Lucille Clifton, and then I'll read some poems and praise songs that I have about certain women from Philadelphia. So the first poem in the book is entitled Shut Up in My Bones, and it's for Harriet Beecher Sproul Hill. I have the racket of anxiety in my jeans. It rivets in ink. Spite this, I leave these marks, this evidence of us undone. In wit's end, it all ferments, and we shape totems of shame from our amusements. The musk of my imagination is as redolent as any untamed woman, and likewise mistaken for mental illness. Perfection is a mask, a perfume in my pulse. I learn to hide what is feared. To be literate is to pen oneself with needles, shape beauty from a funhouse mirror. This is how artists learn the act of display. Call this confession a lie. Look closer. I stub my toe, tight rope walking the lashes of circus clowns. Only the liberated can see the legacies of bondage stirring beyond the ribbons. I have come to know I am the savory morsel in America's teeth. These words are clawed into the enamel. My face is familiar among the haints. I wear her likeness like a call. See, I had a grandma who could read lightning speeds, now some Holy Ghost. The best life I had for her was this country's secondhand soldier, a loving husband, no room for books and babies at her breast. The sanctified think that marriage is a type of reward if you're born second generation out of slavery, the color of coffee bean type of woman, and your hair is some black lacquer of unruly licorice that has branches that wave like echoes. Her smile whiter than seashells, her breath the scent of tobacco, and as narrow as a Carolina pine. With the worries about the rage of white folks, she died gifting me her photos, the only stories that she would write. At birth, her name becomes my velvet lush heirloom, tufted behind my mother's. It is costly to stay free and appear sane. I am she in an extravagant kind, a shimmy spilling from her buttons, the erotic unbridled and a glimmer riding the golden. I am her shrill of laughter, clapping in doubt. Curiosity is my coy friend, chaos my alter ego. I mistook a jagged molar for an ivory tower, and I ain't got the good sense God gave me to rot. So the next poem is a echo or mirror poem for Miss Clifton, for Lucille Clifton. Who was very generous to me when she was alive. I wrote my master's thesis on her, and she allowed me to spend time with her in her home and introduced me to many of the poets that I know today. So in this way, she is an ancestor that's not a blood relative, but of legacy and of love and of light, and I appreciate her. Study the masters, an echo poem from Miss Clifton. I do as you say. I study the masters. I glean close. Your handiwork of words, the discipline you command, all that is huge and hinged with hope are pressed into me. I glean closer. I chant you in form and line. I recall this America, taste the iron musk of her words, the clamor and rickety German and loose Latin always seem to crowd the ear and collect moist in my eye. Okay, are we getting sad already? It's okay. My classes get sad too. Go home and watch some stand-up. Life is about balance. But right now, we're gonna be okay with being sad. All right, so I'm gonna read some of the poems that I've written about women that have spent time in Eastern Penitentiary. These poems were inspired by an anthropologist and sociologist at Rutgers University, Dr. Callie-Ann Gross, who is very, very brilliant. But in addition to being very brilliant, she took such care with the case studies that she researched about African-American women who were incarcerated at Eastern State that once I read the book for research for another project, I just immediately started writing poems about these women. So her work was a source of inspiration and an ephracus. I'm sorry, I probably said that word wrong right now. But she was a source of inspiration. So I want to read a poem for Annie Cutler. And when I read these poems, I'm going to read the piece from Callie and Gross, and then I'm going to go into my poem. So Annie Cutler. On April 22, 1885, Cutler shot and killed an ex-lover, William H. Knight. Cutler's case offers an unprecedented insight into working-class black women's values and their feelings of turmoil and powerlessness. Callie Ann Gross, Colored Amazons. The Confessions of Annie Cutler. Dear Mama, I must go with Knight. I am hellbound. Bury me in a white box in my wedding gown. The remnant of disaster, this grief corsets my sorrows. Pinch and ball snag in this bride's gown. The tongue I praise God with was laid upon Henry. Blasphemy, betrayal, my gown. Mama, I swallowed the bitter syrup of angels, unborn as he lingered around my nightgown. I sipped the tea of penroyal, primrose, and blue-black cohosh, donning this gown. Mother, I tasted the bitterness of three souls, unleavened sacrifices, my gown defiled, doused in bloodstains. Shame suffocates me like a bodice of my gown. Mama, bury me in a white coffin, cover it in earth. Darkness has bequeathed this bride's gown. Pulled to hell in passion's chariots, I will be radiant, veiled in vengeance and the singed scorn of a bridal gown. Once white laced adorned with pearls of piety, the rage smoldering beneath this gratuitous gown of rejection and the fallacy of Henry's promises. I am forsaken as his bride processes in her white gown, her lips plump with smiles and secrets that once belonged to me. She, the fine portrait of domesticity, framed and fringed in her gown, round with his child, the glee of Henry, fury engulfs me, a picture of ruined antiquity, an abandoned Venus in a torn gown. Mama, I choose hell to be my grand ball of debauchery and will stand honorably as the flames feast on my bride's gown. I, Annie Cutler, the Juliet of Henry Knight, will kill him and myself in spite. Please bury me in a white box in my bride's gown. Okay, so very much like today, some of the dilapidated conditions magnify sickness in places of incarceration. And so at Eastern, dilapidated conditions magnified sickness and typhoid and dropsy and tuberculosis ravaged the institution and resulted in a number of inmates' death. Laura Williams, a black woman in her early 20s, convicted in 1887, died of tuberculosis 1 month before her sentence ended. Callie Ann Gross, Colored Amazons. This poem for Laura Williams is entitled Stewing. I dream of hounds, their teeth loose in my veins. Their howls consume me. They growl and feast. She whispers not to run. I can't refrain. Nightmares of this cell stirring in my brain. To survive, I would suckle a possum's teats. I dream of hounds, their teeth loose in my veins. Sweat pours from my body, a heavy rain. My intestine rotting, rinsing. My tongue reeks. She whispers not to run. I can't refrain. Tuberculosis fever stews in my pain, curdles my stomach's bile, vomit creeps, I dream of hounds, their teeth loose in my veins. Awake to my own barking, my voice strained. The nurse's compress grips me like a leash. She whispers not to run, I can't refrain. She tells me to hush as I try to explain. Stale air in this jail, tangled in death's crease. I dream of hounds, their teeth loose in my veins. She whispers, do not run, I cannot refrain. Okay, so I want to move into some other poems. Let's read a happy poem. There aren't many, but let's read a happy poem. And so this poem is for the beloved Sonia Sanchez. And this poem talks about her activism, but some of the activism that's not always discussed in terms of her lifelong commitment to humanity. We usually talk about Sonia Sanchez within the confines of the feminist movement or the Black Arts movement. And this is about a recent protest. So this poem is called, This Granny is Gangsta. Love wears a lanyard laced with Ritas. Love is a pair of bifocals that rims on the nostrils, nursing pouted lips. Love is a granny, a woman weaved from Alabama clay and concrete. One that can fold the names of your enemies in her tongue. A granny that sets out a candy dish full of sparkling laxatives for your bullies. Sonia Sanchez has long been a soldier of love. She wields protests like wind. At 82, she marches like she is leading a second line. Awe at her knees. With her cane, she cracks blessings and calls your nearest kin. She speaks peace in a cadence of prayers. The army slithers down Broad Street, wanting weapons gilded from flesh. She shows the recruiter that freedom can't be paid for with my grandchildren's lives. Her love is strong. It's all knuckles and knotted. It's 1, 2, 3, 4. Love doesn't want your bloody war. And I think I will end with a poem to Sandra Bland. And it's called Sandy Speaks. Hashtag Sandy Speaks is a choral refrain. And it kind of references her own activism that she was engaged in via social media. It could have been me, with 3 degrees creased into the front seats, bits of the Constitution in my veins like Braille, the declarations tattooed inside of my eyelids. How many times did Sally Hemings have to hear about them and affirm the tiny ego of Tom before he bears himself to his brothers, collecting their boastings and forgiving their debts? It could have been me. Like Sandy, I would have missed them dashes in the road, the way I skirt around corners under the cover of sun, eye fleeing an interview, happy to have some means, pockets fluffy with promises. It could have been me, listening to the gospel, the lilts in my throat, running, and a marble of fog above my lips. My car would be all clouds of heaven, shaved with blue and red lights. It could have been me, my eyebrows high, my voice low, questioning Ancinia about his bidding. It could have been me, a black woman, the color of Oklahoma clay, a policeman pretending to be some cowboy. Sandy had been in Texas but a day. How long had he been hunting for one like her? Ancinia seeing this in his mind. It was a means of forgetting the woman that refused to love him and the black man she clung to. In this vision, he is a rodeo-style hero, and Sandy is some rogue rascal. He holds out his tongue to the shower of coins and praises. A black woman without a job only owns her dignity. Did his fantasy desire that too? He minded out of her back with his knees. History told him that he could squeeze gold from a black woman's wrist with iron cuffs. Is that why he braided a noose to resemble a lasso? So thank you for listening.
Can we get another round of applause for Damaris? I gotta tell you, I picked up that book and it's been hard to put down. I've never read anything like that, and it's amazing. I'm gonna put on my readers, because I've reached that age where I need readers. But bifocals ain't that cute. So here we go. The first time someone accused me of being a CIA agent, I laughed hard. I could not believe that anyone would make such an absurd assertion. Me? I'm just one woman, born in Queens and raised in the Bronx, a hood girl made good, put in a big fancy degree to work in action by fighting systemic racism, sexism, and classism. I have been a pro-black liberation activist, feminist writer, and community organizer since the late 90s. Yet somehow, my public identity as a feminist woman led to suspicions that I was a government agent. This was a disturbing revelation to me, to say the least. Then someone accused me of being an FBI agent, charged with imprisoning black men in an effort to further destroy the black family. This time, I did not laugh as hard. Instead, I began to experience a heavy burden of hopelessness and futility. How could people whom I have gone out of my way to defend and for whose needs I've advocated at a risk to my own safety and that of my family believe that I would do anything to break up black families or damage black communities? I began to wonder seriously, who and what am I fighting for? I'm not the only feminist these detractors claim is working with the United States government. Gloria Steinem has been accused of being a CIA plant who's lured black women into embracing feminism in a larger plot to make black communities implode and self-destruct. Other times, they say we are working with groups like COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program that operated from 1956 to 1971 to defuse Communist Party activities, causing chaos and division. They simply do not believe that black feminism is a legitimate liberation movement, and they have convinced themselves that any black woman who subscribes to black feminist theoretical framework and ideologies is a white man-worshipping, self-loathing, traitorous agent of white supremacy. Well, I'm none of those things, right? So, I ain't no damn agent, okay? Look, me and the government ain't been friends. I wait till April 16th to send in my taxes, and I don't give them an interest-free loan throughout the year, all right? How many of you have the book? Ooh, how many gonna get the book? Okay. Damn. Shit. You know, the white man got $2 million for a 2-book deal, only to find out that his ass was lying about everything. We give mediocre white men everything, and we gotta fight for the rest. Buy my damn book. Okay, black feminism. Black feminism is the key to black liberation. I believe this without quiver or qualm, as I have yet to encounter any other theoretical template that offers a better pathway to the promise of black people's liberation from centuries of systemic race-based oppression. Everything represented within and by the black feminist movement affirms the entirety and complexity of life at the intersections of not only race and gender, but also sexual identity, ethnicity, class, religion, size, disability, access, immigration status, and nationality. It maintains, thank you, sexual chocolate. It maintains that sexism, racism, and classism function together and are not individual oppressions to be fought separately. It understands that all Black people must be accepted and affirmed as human beings worthy of freedom, liberty, dignity, and civil rights if any of us are to be. In this way, Black feminism inherently advocates for Black men, disabled Black folks, queer Black folks, poor Black folks, illiterate Black folks, undocumented Black immigrants, fat Black folks who pray, and Black folks who have found another way. I repeat, Black feminism is the key to Black liberation. Y'all ain't gotta clap every time, but I damn sure love it. At its core, Black feminism is the embodiment of vital, multi-layer anti-oppression work, born of a natural understanding of resistance as survival. If we want to broaden our understanding of it fully, we cannot ignore its roots. And since Black feminism has consistently posed a tangible threat to Black male hegemony and white female privilege, I always deem it important to point out that Black women have been focused on the same issues for over a century, and we are neither better nor worse on one battlefront. Where all the women are white and all the Blacks are men, we are not white enough to be women and too womanly to be Black. We're gonna pass around a plate after this. All right, so the book is called From the Tweets to the Streets, right? Why is it called? We'll talk about that later. All right, so it's called From the Tweets to the Streets. As I said, I am from the Boogie Down Bronx. I am a hood girl through and through. When I moved here, I moved to North Philly, 18th and Susquehanna. You know how it is. And then I moved to East Oak Lane because, well, in words. It messed up my car, and I wanted a house, but that's who I am, and so for me, it was important to represent those women and people in the streets who don't have access to all these big words that we sometimes use, and they don't have access to the academy, and I feel somewhat responsible as someone who has gotten entrance to be able to take what I've learned and make it accessible for other people, so that's why I talk about the streets. And throughout the book, you're going to see quotations from women in hip-hop. Every chapter opens with a quotation from a female MC. But anyway, I've done some campaigning, some work, you may have heard of it, a thing called UO Cases, which is a street anti-street harassment campaign. And it was a hashtag, and it did all of these great stuff. But I wanted to talk about, you'll get the section, whatever. Street harassment is on the spectrum of the kinds of violence women experience, as is sexual harassment at work. So Me Too and UO Cases function in tandem to combat the daily bullshit women deal with outside of their homes. What goes on inside the home is another issue entirely, and speaking up about intimate partner spousal violence is often met with such denial, erasure, and vitriol that it's any wonder that women bother to complain at all. An estimated 57% of all mass shootings are related to domestic violence, with many of the instances involving a man attempting to and succeeding at killing his partner and or their children and other members of the family or close friends who happen to be in the vicinity. And with more than 20,000 calls per day to domestic violence hotlines from the estimated 10 million people who experience some form of intimate partner violence, the matter continues to plague our society. And I'm going to talk about Beverly Gooden because I have some other background, but she started a hashtag called Why I Stayed. In 2014, Beverly Gooden, a Black feminist woman, launched the hashtag Why I Stayed to address the issue. We often hear people say, in reaction to finding out women remain with abusive partners, why did she stay? It is a victim-blaming tactic that places the burden of responsibility for violence on the women. Gooden challenged the notion by explaining that she stayed in an abusive relationship and why she stayed in an abusive relationship, and other people joined in sharing their own stories and experiences. It would help if I read. The hashtag opened up the conversation about why it is not simple or easy to leave a violent relationship and became one of the top feminist hashtags of the year. As often is the case, black women's experiences with intimate partner violence have not been prominent in news reporting. Cheryl Salt James, one half of the iconic hip-hop duo Salt-N-Pepa, emphasized the importance of speaking out about abuse. I think the key to changing the kind of abuse and inequality women have had to live with is that we have to talk about it with one another and be there for one another and support one another. The rapper Eve also spoke about domestic violence when she chronicled the history of losing her close friend who stayed with an abusive man to domestic violence in her 1990 hit Love is Blind. The song offered a poignant, necessary perspective as women who live in poverty and the hood experience intimate partner violence at 7 times the rate of those who do not. She raps about her best friend being under the power of a man who repeatedly abused her and eventually killed her. Her storytelling connected with the women who needed to receive a dose of reality and encouragement to seek help if they were being abused. And so for me, as a child of hip-hop, right, raised in hip-hop culture, I accessed feminism through hip-hop first. And I was lucky enough to be able to support what I had learned with studying the theories and going to school. But what I talk about is the ways in which we are transforming how we share knowledge. And black women are changing the way we share knowledge. And it is rooted in African tradition. And this next thing that I'm going to talk about is a theory that I'm presenting here. And I expand on it, and I don't think that it's been talked about enough. So I fleshed out this theory. Twitter is call and response. So I was talking about how I first came on Twitter. I got on there because I wanted to talk to Questlove. So the way they built Twitter was like, so yo, all your favorite celebrities are here in real time. You can go and you can act them and they may see it. So I was like, yo, I had a crush on him at the time. And I was like, I'm going to go at Questlove because I'm going through a divorce, goddammit. So it was very much a call and response dynamic. And I began to think that maybe this is why black women so successfully connected with each other in these spaces. I argue that call and response, as rooted in traditional African cultural communication, is inherent to black women's speech patterns across the diaspora. It makes sense to me, then, that platforms designed to encourage a call and response style of communication would draw in black women especially and be ripe for evolution through our contributions. As Twitter is designed to foster conversations by using the at sign, which was long recognized as at in internet language, the premise is structured around the idea of speaking at someone as opposed to speaking with someone. One person types something and two respond, users have to direct their typed words at them in their responses. If others bear witness to the exchange, they too can respond at the original call and to the subsequent responses. Call and response generally involves a person or group of people communicating in one way and a person or group of people responding directly to or at that initial communication in a way that often acknowledges the call. In the majority of exchanges, the response affirms the call by offering a word of agreement or a positive sound that provides background emphasis, but sometimes the response challenges or questions the call. The response may inspire or infuriate the caller, whose flow is largely contingent upon the kind of response it generates. It is an exchange, so there is arguably an occasional noticeable shift between who acts as the caller and who acts as the respondent. Ultimately, this is a collaborative experience in which exchanges are necessary and participants are connected through an intimate understanding of this ebb and flow. For black people, the best example of this exchange can be found in charismatic houses of worship, mostly of Christian denominations. A preacher stands in the pulpit at the front of the church and delivers a sermon punctuated by the responses of the congregation. Similar to the black pastor's sermonized word, often presented with a sing-song cadence, a tweet functions as an antiphon or a sung biblical verse shouted from the tweeter's pulpit or their timeline. As such, quote tweeting and retweeting are, as a cultural practice, antiphony, or the singing, chanting of hymnal verses simultaneously by at least two different voices, making Twitter a forum rooted in the African call and response tradition. So then it makes sense that Black women are the prominent figures within the medium, as we are the primary conduits of antiphony. We fill the pews and are the ones heard responding to and supporting the collaboration between preachers and congregants during Sunday sermons through call and response. Our retweets are the congregational amens, whereas quote tweets, which are retweets with added commentary, or direct responses are our community's immediate response through the word, through their own immediate interpretation. As one of us pieces together and presents our sermons, others participate by echoing our words, retweeting, amplifying the message by co-signing it, quote tweeting, and engaging in the development of the message, even influencing its direction as we immediately and directly influence the originator's train of thought through our direct response. That's what I got. So I write about it more, but you know, kind of think about it. That's some brilliant shit right there. Like, real talk. Okay, I gotta cut it down because I'm getting the signal. So do I want to talk about white people or bed wenches? This is a call and response. Am I talking about white women or being a Negro bed wench? You said the bed wench. I hate y'all for that because, yeah, we'll talk about it. You know, okay. Who knows what a Negro bed wench is? Negro bed wench stems from the misguided notion that there were enslaved Black women who willingly became their masters' mistresses and enjoyed the so-called benefits of being their concubines. Despite everything we know and understand about people in bondage being unable to legitimately consent to much of anything demanded of them by those who own the rights to their bodies, these men are adamant in their assertions that Black women happily hopped into the bed with their masters and strove towards being awarded such a position. They've even taken to using the term bedbuck to describe gay Black men who have sex and or romantic relationships with white men and who they believe are working against the Black community because of the rewards gained by being a bedmate to a white person. I've been called a Negro bedwench for the last 6 years, okay? I ain't never slept with a white man in my life. No disrespect, but I just haven't. We're gonna tell the truth, I'm just gonna say it. And so it's a caricature, and it's a bit old school, and it gained traction when the television series Scandal, which was created by Shonda Rhimes and featured Black American actress Kerry Washington as Olivia Pope, began to rise to popularity. The show centered a white Republican president who's having an affair with a Black woman known for solving political drama and getting major figures out of trouble or making them pay for their errant ways. I'm skipping through whatever. Consequently, Negro bedwench became a popular insult for women who openly identified as Black feminists because of the notion that Black feminism is not a real concept and exists only to serve white supremacy. It's even been used to describe Black women who wear weaves and makeup, Black women who cosplay, and pretty much any Black woman who does not exist as the queen Hotep Twitter believes she should be. I won't go any further other than to say that, how many of you have heard of Hotep Twitter? Where did that come from? Anybody know where it came from? Me, 2013. Thank you. That's it. You clap it up. That's it.
Okay.
Mic check 1, 2, 1, 2. We in the house.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Well, thanks again to Feminista and Damaris. We were talking backstage and I'll throw this out to get us started. It seems writers have to write the book that they have to write. Why did you have to write these books at this moment?
I'll start with this. This is my third first poetry manuscript. And what I mean by that is I began writing a poetry manuscript in 2001 as a part of my master's thesis. I revisited it, reorganized it, flushed it out in 2012, and gave it a name. And that name was Bound because of the multiple entendres. It was around that time that I started studying Black women in incarceration, because if you love Black women and you come across a statistic that says 814% increase in Black women incarceration over the next decade or over the past decade, then you begin investigating that because you love Black women. So then I acquired an agent, Charlotte Sheedy, who has also been a literary agent to Audre Lorde, but the work that most people know is her work with Lemony Snicket. But it's important to say that she was Audre Lorde's agent because she gets me, right? And when you have an ally and a partner, you want that partner to understand you, not for one aspect of self, but for multiple, if not all, aspects of self. And I feel very honored to have someone that has worked with Audre Lorde. You know, I found her for my novel about girls that went to prison during the Depression era. And a year after we formed that relationship, she found out that I wrote poetry and nonfiction. And as soon as she read the poems about the women in Eastern Penitentiary, she said, "The poems are coming out first." And I started to build a poetry manuscript around the histories, but simultaneously our cultural, you know, environment is shifting. And it's becoming a very painful time for me and many people that I know. So I decided not to be suicidal, not to be depressed, and I decided that I was going to learn to live, negotiate power, and resist. And in order to do that, I had to take my daily Black feminist womanist vitamin, and those vitamins became these poems.
What was the question? Why did Riley write that?
Yeah,
that was amazing. I just love how she talks.
Whatever.
It's so soothing. It is. Because I wanted money. And I wanted to write about me and my friends. And that's what this book is about. Go get it.
That's love.
No. you know, Black women have been erased from everything. We are still learning about the things that Black women have done. We are those hidden figures, right? And I thought that it was super important to capture this moment with what, you know, Tarana's doing, what I'm doing, what Trudy's doing, what Jamila's doing, what all these people that I could name, all these women that I know and love personally, we're all doing really great things. And people who tell our stories sometimes get them wrong. And, you know, I didn't want, honestly, a non-Black woman telling our story. And a lot of people get paid to write articles about us. We don't see none of that money. People will win awards writing about us. We won't see any of it. So I wanted to make sure that I documented our history as a primary source so that 100 years from now, when people want to know what was feminism like in the early 21st century, they can pick this up and they can read it and count it as a primary source. So, that's that.
There's somebody right here in the third row.
Oh, questions, awesome. How are you doing? Jump right in, come on.
Hi. Okay, I didn't know that was not expected. Okay, hi, thank you. So I was wondering from your perspective as a professor and then your perspective as someone who's active on social media, what your thoughts are on quote-unquote cancel culture and sort of the, cancel culture and everything that that entails.
I have a whole section called Problematic Faves. Child, I've been canceled so many times, and yet I'm still here on a book tour.
Can you talk about it for people who
might know what it is? Yes, so what is cancel culture? It's a misnomer, in my opinion. I think it's this idea that somebody does something wrong and they are canceled. We are never supporting them again, and they got to go away forever. I don't like it, partly because Black women are always the ones who are the most disadvantaged in that. White men can get away with saying they want to walk around killing Black people, and they're going to get taken number 16, going to come out next year. So, but Black women can make a mistake, and they're done. We never hear from them again. I think that we have lost our grasp on understanding that people are human beings. A few years ago, I wrote about digital intimacy and how that is assumed. People think that just because they follow you on social media, they know you, and that they can speak to you any kind of way, and they won't get their jaws snatched out. And so when you respond, they get upset, and they want to cry about it. And, you know, it's, I'm like, that's not how it works. On the other hand, there are people who, you know, like myself, used to say things that I'm ashamed of. I don't like it. And I explain in the book how I was, you know, raised with a lot of things. My mom was a queer woman, but I was still raised, you know, being transphobic. And in my early Twitter days, there were a lot of things that I said that if I went back and read, I was just like, oh my gosh, like, I hate it. I own it, and I'm sorry, and I'll never do it again. But it's like, yes, I did that. And there's some people who think, well, you should have never been that way. Well, actually, okay, like, I get it. You were born woke as hell. Great. I wasn't. I wasn't. And everything that you're talking about right now, you learned from me anyway, so relax. So for me, it's like we are taking a modern lens and applying it to the past. And instead of allowing people to atone and to say, you know what, that was messed up, and I've grown from it, we badger and badger and badger and badger and badger till people lash out like, well, forget you then. And we shouldn't do that. But then there's people like Kevin Hart, right, who go around like, I'm not talking about this no more. He goes on 8 different shows to say he's not talking about this anymore because he doesn't feel like he has to keep apologizing for some things that he said. But I want you to also notice people focused on the homophobic slurs and not all the horrible shit he said about Black women. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think that we are reactionary because we have 24/7 access to everything these days. And so we think that we know everything, and we think we have the right to cancel someone's life because we didn't like something that they said. When I think that we need to learn how to engage in critical conversations more and show some more humanity and extend grace to those who really are just trying to do the right thing.
I totally agree with everything that FJ said. I believe in kind of call-in culture, if you're prepared to call somebody in rather than call out and cancel culture. But just from a practical point of view, right, in terms of strategy. So, like, if you are about social change, you have to strategize what your role is and how you're going to advocate within that role. And there takes all types of people to transform a culture that is white supremacist and patriarchal, where, let's say, at least 87% of the culture buys into some of those ideologies. So just from a practical perspective of numbers, I don't think we can afford to throw any advocates away, right? But we can afford to help them evolve into better advocates and people.
Good evening, and thank you. By way of introduction, Feminista, I'm meeting you in person. You have agreed to be a speaker at the 3rd Annual Summit for Women and Girls, sponsored by the Philadelphia Commission for Women. Yes. But I didn't say that to, I didn't stand up to do a plug. what I did want to know is, and this is for both of you, one of the things that I encounter, I'm a boomer, and I encounter from my social circle the whole idea they want to be womenists and not feminists. Mm-hmm. And I have been proudly, my entire adult life, have claimed being a Black feminist mm-hmm. because I believe I own mm-hmm. the term. Mm-hmm. It was my ancestors that created feminism mm-hmm. out of the abolition movement. So if we both could address that so that I love that you claim being a black feminist, mm-hmm. as I do. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like for both of you to address the apprehension of claiming that, because as we know, black women were left out of second wave feminism mm-hmm. by white women. And that resentment is part of the reason why black women don't want to claim feminism. So if you could address, both of you address that, I certainly would appreciate it.
What you got to say?
Oh, well, you know, what I have to say is pretty short. Number one, I don't have a problem with the term black feminist. I use the term womanist more often than black feminist. One, because Alice Walker came up with that term. But two, it also allows me to talk about certain spiritual aspects that are invested in those ideologies that I think black feminism, you can have with black feminism, but the definition of black feminism doesn't explicitly embrace the spiritual aspects directly. We talk about ethics and morals, right? And real life applications. So I use the term womanist primarily to honor Alice Walker, not to be exclusive or to be against the term black feminist, because I am a black feminist. That's, you know?
So. I mean, it's purple and lavender, right? That's what she right. said. It's all the same shades. Mm-hmm. You know, you walk past the color purple and don't acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Make God angry.
Make God angry. So I'm not of that spiritual tradition, and I use it interchangeably. I put it in the book because I honor that. To me, it's black and African American. It's like whatever. I don't know. Everybody has their own name. Everybody has a right to call themselves Coochie Chocolate. You can name yourself, yeah. determine for yourself yeah. how you want to be called. My name is Feminista Jones. If you approach me by my government name, I probably will not answer because that's not how I introduce myself to you. And I have the right to mm-hmm. say that, and I have the right to do that. I call myself a black feminist exactly why you say. We created this. I don't want to sit at the table. My ancestors built the table and the chairs. They set the mm-hmm. table. They cooked the food and they served it to you. Therefore, you should be asking to sit at mine. Mm-hmm. And so when I say black feminist, I am reminding you that mm-hmm. this is blackness Absolutely. All up in your feminism. And every single liberation movement in the 20th century and below is modeled after black liberation blueprints. So any feminism you got, whatever wave it is, it came from black women any damn way. So mm-hmm. I am totally black feminist. But I use it interchangeably in the book. If you're a womanist, you're a womanist. If you're a black feminist, you're a black feminist. Shit, they left all of us out, so right. it don't even matter. Yeah. They wasn't thinking about us when we helped them get the right to get abortions. So.
I just want to say I follow you both on Twitter mm-hmm. for a few years now, and I'm always in Thank awe you. At the thoughts that you all have, the interactions that you have with your audience. It's absolutely amazing, and I'm so happy that these books are now public for us to indulge in. I love how Feminista says that this is a primary source, because that's absolutely 100 facts. There's mm-hmm. nowhere else we can find a book that actually articulates the tweets that we send, because there are thousands, mm-hmm. millions. And I wanted to speak about something that you both kind of mentioned while introducing yourself and reading excerpts, was that, one, you found knowledge in the power, and that you had to negotiate your power, and that, Feminista, you said that hip-hop transformed the way that you thought about the world, and that, you know, you wanted to gain more access for women that are in the streets that weren't really in the academy. Mm-hmm. So I'm just interested to know and curious to find out what were the challenges that you all faced when writing this book? Because it's, one, very emotional. Two, it's a lot of knowledge. You all literally conceptualized and articulated thousands of hashtags, thousands of tweets. But I think it's different, especially for the black body encountering tweets, because it's so emotional. It's either rage, it's it's sadness, it's you know, disenfranchisement. So right. I just want to know, what kind of challenges did you all face when approaching these topics?
So this is a great question. What challenges? This book for me, for many that don't know, I'm also a mental health advocate. I live with psychiatric disabilities. And when people ask me like what the writing process was, right? And it's like, oh, how long did it take you to write the book? And I was like, well, I wrote about 80% of it in a month. And I did that because I was manic. I was in like one of the worst depressions right after I got this deal. And I couldn't do anything. And I started taking medication or whatever, but my medication numbs my creativity. I can't write, you know? I'm flat. I'm not up, I'm not down. And so I made the conscious decision to go off of my medication so that I would have something. And it was hard. It was hard, it was hard. I got a friend in the audience right now who could tell you how hard it was, but that's what it took for me to write this. And I was able to pour forth all of that anger, all of that trauma, all of that pain. But then I was also feeling the joy and exhilaration and all those things that are numbed by my medication. And I was able to pour all of that in. But because I was in kind of this manic state, I was just, I was literally writing about 4,000 words a day. And it was just, and they were, and honestly, when I handed it in to my editor, she handed it back and it was lightly edited. So it was just, so now, when I go and I read this, I stumble over the words sometimes because I don't remember writing a lot of it. It's because of where I was. So if we want to talk about challenges, right? So kind of being a manic genius, I guess. And then feeling like I can't tap into that when I'm medicated. That's the hardest part. And then I've been in this existential crisis of, am I actually a good writer or am I just psychotic? So maybe both, right? So that's that.
You're definitely a great writer. Let's start with that.
Thank you. So
I had a similar experience. And we, FJ and Andy and I have already discussed this. But I found out when I was in writer's residence working on these poems that my son, who is a very ambitious person, that wants to be at the forefront of national politics, was addicted to cocaine. So the last chapter of the book wasn't initially a part of this book. The extended violence of the Black Lives Matter movement, right? So I was very depressed, you know? I had my son at a very young age. I raised my son as a single mother in Baltimore and other places. You know, when my son announced at a very young age that he wanted to be in politics, I invested everything I had to make those opportunities available to him. He was very successful. He was a child of hope. Post-racial, even. Racism existed because me and my friends in African American studies brought it up, according to my son, before this most recent presidential election. So, you know, many of us in this room know how hard it is to raise a black child that dreams incessantly, that has a vision for the future that hasn't been designed yet. That's what was taken from me, right? So I was extremely depressed. And I needed these poems to kind of meditate and get my way through. But also during the, and it took me about 2 months to fill out this book with the drafts. Shout out to Furious Flower Poetry Center at George Madison, at James Madison University, because when I began drafting, even before I got to the McDowell Colony, I said, I need to, I called the director, Joanne Gavin,
And I said, I'm on my way to Baltimore to stay with my friend to write these poems. But my friend has a dog. And I'm not strong enough not to pay attention to the dog. If the dog wants to go out, I'm going to let the dog out. Mm-hmm. And she said, come here. She gave me 3 weeks and a magnificent home where I could cook all of my own food. And I was left alone. And in that space, I probably drafted 48 poems in that 3 weeks. And then I probably took another 2 months to fill out the book. But then, you know, right before I garnered the contract and I was working with my agent with edits, it is painful to keep going into the book because it's kind of like method writing. Like I have to revisit the experiences with such an intimacy that I have to feel my way through, right? And so towards the end of that type of revision process, I was like, you have to give me page numbers, because if I have to read through all of the poems again, mm-hmm. I won't come up for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Even now, I have a hard time reading the Sandra Bland poem. I have yet to read that poem without stuttering. I haven't even really read any of the poems about my son aloud. Mm-hmm. There's some I haven't even heard aloud. So, that's mm-hmm. a part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Shout out to Uncle Bobby's, because yes. I had to make sure I got out the house. And I was over there in my sweats, and Mark would see me. I'm like, I'm working on it. And, shout out to Uncle Bobby's real quick.
And unfortunately, we are out of time. Please join me in thanking Feminista Jones and Damaris B. Hill.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.